This is Filming the Supernatural. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Ben Goldman. I'm your host. I know I keep saying this at the top of the episodes, but this is another one of my favorite interviews, which really should come as no shock to anyone, because anyone that knows me knows that Hellier is probably what I consider to be one of the best paranormal series of all time. And today I get the honor of speaking with Carl Pfeiffer, the director, editor, and camera operator of the series. Now, I do want to admit, it was a bit challenging dwindling down all the questions I could have asked Carl, and I tried to keep it all pertained solely to the production and the actual filming of the series. But there may be some spoilers and plot elements scattered throughout this interview, so I just wanted to say, if you haven't seen Hellier already, please visit hellier.tv to learn more about the series and how you can watch it. It's available on Amazon Prime and YouTube. So, without further ado, here's Carl Pfeiffer.
So my background, it's kind of scattershot, really, because I'm very much a YouTube university filmmaker, so to speak, very self-taught. I really developed a passion for video in middle school and high school, kind of taking classes, a couple of the video classes that were offered. But even at that point, it didn't really seem super feasible as a career to kind of chase down at that point. I don't know if that was, all the living in Colorado and you hear about actors, and how hard it is to actually act. I don't know if I just kind of transposed that onto the actual crew side of it as well, or just what, but this was back in the era of like mini DV tapes and whatnot too. So what I was shooting in high school, I was proud of, but the gap to like shooting something professionally felt like a very far kind of a gap. And so I wound up going to college for creative writing. And in the middle of college, I was cast on and later won the first season of an old show called Ghost Hunters Academy, which was a lot of fun. And it gave me an interesting kind of glimpse into the behind the scenes of like how reality television works. From there, I kind of like moved on to an episode of the international spinoff of the show. And then they never called me back. And I spent the next couple of years trying to get back on TV to no avail. But it was during that time that I got really into photography. I had a number of friends that were into it. So I picked up an entry-level Canon camera. And I had a friend that told me that, if like this is a really good camera, she said, and if you put that thing on auto and just shoot on auto, like I'm going to kill you. And I took that to heart. I put it on manual and I never went back. Just learned everything there was to know about it. And, eventually kind of upgraded to a camera that could shoot video as well. And so kind of learning photo and video were sort of parallel tracks, despite me focusing more on photo. And so after going to school for writing, I self-published a couple books that didn't really go anywhere, and I burned out on that. And that's when I pivoted to photography and learning about lighting and learning about the camera systems and editing and whatnot, and kind of burnt out on that a little bit and pivoted more into video with working up at the Stanley Hotel was kind of the main impetus for that, because after a couple of years of that, we started shooting the web series Spirits of the Stanley, which was kind of my first little exercise at making something that was more narrative based. And then from that, the Stanley canned all the ghost related stuff and we didn't have a job anymore. We didn't have a web series, and we were working with a production company on trying to get a TV show off the ground that was kind of like a Spirits of the Stanley. And so I was a producer on that, but it was all just development. It didn't wind up going anywhere, but I spent so much energy on focusing what I wanted to see in a paranormal series that was different from everything that had come before, that by the time that the show was kind of dying and that we kind of realized that the production company we were working with wasn't really closing any deals, I was very just desperate to try to put some of these ideas into motion. And during that time, I had heard the Hellier story that starts off Hellier, with the podcast with Euphemet. And I was kind of imagining shooting that with some money and some crew from this TV show that never happened. And so towards the end there, I was just like, screw it. Like, I want to try to put this in motion, whatever this project is going to be. Let's grab a couple friends. Let's compile all the gear that me and some friends have. And let's just go shoot this thing. And the rest, I think, is on the screen. You know, like I think you can kind of see me figuring it out as I go, as the seasons of Hellier progress. But aside from doing some promo work and stuff for friends and clients here and there, it's been primarily kind of those passion projects driving the ship. And they're not all out, you know, because we're on a couple of year delay as these, you know, creative projects go. But that's
very time consuming work.
Yeah. Yeah. Scheduling and release plans always tend to put a bit of a delay on things. And, you know, a global pandemic for a couple of years doesn't help either.
Exactly. Now, something I picked up on, especially in the first and maybe beginning of second season, was the sort of implication that Hellier was originally going to be a singular, you know, standard hour and a half doc.
Yeah, it wasn't necessarily expecting an hour and a half long thing so much as we didn't know what it was going to be at all. And the idea of doing it as a long form series was the most ambitious of them. And so it was sort of like the most removed from what it could be, because we didn't know if we were just going to go test the waters, if it was going to be a mini doc or maybe become a sizzle reel that we could kind of pitch around. And so much of that first season is in basically real time. You know, we went out for about a week and a half, and those couple days in Hellier, we shot just about everything. And I know that some people would say it should have been an hour and a half long documentary, but just like, there was so much nuance and subtlety that happened in that first season that we kind of came to the conclusion that presenting it in a deliberate kind of along for the ride sort of a way made some of those subtleties a lot more significant, because the viewers got to experience them the same way that we did. And so as I was sitting down at my computer to work with it when I got home, it started to turn into a multi-episode. And I love series. I think probably even more than movies. I'm working on a feature doc right now, and it's oddly more complicated to try to work in the constraints of that time, where those little nuances of editing seem to matter almost a little bit more, I think. But yeah, I think that it was kind of exciting to have the opportunity to work in a space where with series, you know, and long form stuff, I really love that. And so it was fun to bring that into this project that we had no idea what it was going to be when we started.
Now, what I'm wondering is how that affects your preparation and the pre-production for the project as a whole, going in not knowing exactly what it's going to be, and then it resulting in a several hour multi-part series.
That's a good question. From the get-go, I think not knowing what it was going to be kind of matched our resources as well, because I don't have a very big network. So, you know, we brought out my buddy Rashad, who has worked a little bit in film, more so in the last few years since Hellier, but he had a couple of Canon 5D Mark IIIs and a batch of lenses. I had my Canon 60 and some lenses, you know, and I had some buddies that I'd worked with on a couple of projects that had like a small media company. So I borrowed some lights and stuff from them. But we kind of figured after dipping our toes in the web series kind of production, which was just kind of me with my camera, a different buddy with his camera, and we would just kind of shoot. And we figured that was good enough. The more that I've learned over time, the more that you understand better, like where to allocate some of those resources to its detriment. You know, the sound in Hellier season one was not very great. And so like, if I had had a resource there, that would have been somebody to bring on. But it was kind of just a matter of maximizing what we had. And, you know, it's nice in that way, because when you're shooting kind of stripped down like that, there's not as many needs for more, you know, especially in terms of like batteries, like shooting on the Canon 60 and 5D. Like when you're not running like a monitor or an external recorder, you can get away with just like packing a handful of batteries. Each one will last you a couple hours and you'll be fine with it. So it was easy that way to just kind of run really light, which worked well, especially going to this area like Hellier, where we didn't want to call too much attention to ourselves, like shooting some big TV show. So having that small package was really helpful. And we kind of took that web series approach, just go handheld, very run and gun. Having Rashad as kind of a dedicated cameraman, because like my background's an investigator, and I like to hold the camera. So I was kind of juggling both of those. I brought Connor from Spirits of the Stanley on as just kind of like he we joke about it now because he didn't really know what he was doing there. He's like, you know, I could see it where I'm like, yeah, you're an investigator, but you can also help. And you're just kind of a part of the crew on both sides of the camera. And he's gradually grown into his role now. But it was just very off the cuff, which worked for all of us, I think, because most of us didn't really have that filmmaking background where we had any sort of expectations on what things should or shouldn't be like in the process. Rashad, not being in the paranormal space, just jumped on the camera and just shot everything the whole time. And then I would kind of shoot as much as I could too, but also being aware of the fact that I was on camera a handful of times as well. So it was very loose, somewhat disorganized, other than the fact that like we knew we were getting the content that we needed because cameras were kind of rolling all around the clock. But it's gotten honed a lot more since then. Yeah.
Sure, it helped too that you were also the editor. It's not like you dumped all this footage on someone else to have to sort through what was significant and what wasn't.
Yeah. Yeah. I think kind of starting out as in growing up into this like solo shooter, I don't even know what all the terms for them are these days, but we're in this like YouTube era, you know, where we have all these like all the camera packages and resources are getting smaller and smaller. And you have so many people that are self-taught that they become one of those jack of all trades who does the shooting. So then they're the DP as well. And they're in control of the process from start to finish. So they're a director and a producer. And then they sit down in the edit bay. And that was really the way that I came to it because I think when you're climbing the Hollywood ladder, you get to experience all those different singular roles on the set individually. And that becomes the way that you think of a production. Whereas I think when you approach just making something creative as a person with a camera, you, I think, gradually wear more and more of those hats. And I think anyone that goes through that approach starts to realize like where their limitations are. And some of those limitations are solved by just like spending more time and watching more tutorials. And some of those are just like not something that some people excel at. And so then you have to sort of outsource. So I was kind of lucky enough that, you know, I kind of had enough of an editing background and a storytelling background from writing that it felt very natural to edit my own work. At the same time, I think that, you know, there's kind of a joke that I catch edges of when I hear different industry people talking about my work. And there's an idea that like a shooter shouldn't edit their own work because every other shot is their favorite shot and they want to keep it all in. And the whole idea behind a lot of wrapping something up into an edit is to keep it tight and fast and moving. And though I wanted to do something thoughtful and artsy with these paranormal doc projects like Hellier, it is still important to keep that pace up. And so it's been kind of a learning process over the last few years of the fact that I might be able to like tell a story well, and, you know, I shoot it well enough, I guess, but learning how to be a good critic of my own work to keep that pace and to give me some guidelines, I think is really helpful, because without that, it's very easy to like lose that tight, concise focus in your storytelling. And so that's been a gradual process that I think is important from like a solo shooter and operator. But it also helps with somebody starting out too, because I didn't have the stress of delivering a bunch of footage that, as was the learning experience of Hellier, some of that footage was hot garbage. I rented a Sony A7S2 for the shoot and did, for a couple of shots, just about everything wrong as a combination of settings that I could do. And I think delivering that to a professional or another editor, I think would have been really stressful for me, because I can handle working with that in post and my faults and flaws with it. However, I think somebody else, I would have felt a little bit mortified passing that footage off to.
Now, season two had some subtle changes I picked up on. It's also a lot more ambitious.
Mm-hmm.
More people, more locations, more on-camera interviews as opposed to over the phone. Were these deliberate decisions based on discussions you guys had after the first season wrapped?
Yeah.
Or was it more of a boost in budget that allowed you to have more freedom?
I think it was kind of a natural progression of all of those things in a lot of ways, where the first season, like, you know, sometimes I kind of count Hellier season one as like my first project that I really did. And other times it's kind of the second, depending on usually how recently I've seen clips of Spirits of the Stanley, because I think sometimes I write that off as just kind of having fun. And other times I'll see it and be like, actually, that kind of holds up. That was kind of a fun little project. So, but regardless, Hellier one was the real like first time I tried to do something like that. And so even beyond just like critiques and notes amongst ourselves, I think that just by doing season one, I learned a lot going into season two in terms of how to tell that story. The timeline is super wacky too, because we shot season one, like I said, over the course of a week and a half in 2017. And then we tried to figure out what we wanted to do with it over the course of the next like year and a half or so. And so we were starting to shoot season two before season one was released. And we gotten some feedback from some network people and production companies that we were talking to, because we were trying to figure out if we wanted to release it like on TV. But I was trying to do something, you know, like I work from a lot of inspiration sources, like stuff that I'm consuming that I'm like, wow, I love this. I want to bring elements of that to what I do. It's kind of like,
what were some of those inspirations?
Yeah. Very much at that time, the one that I go back to a lot is like Chef's Table, which is a Netflix doc series that was this really like thoughtful, artsy, slow motion B-roll, lots of sit-down interviews, beautiful footage, took a cooking show completely away from a lot of the like set pieces or reality cooking shows that they'd seen before. And I just loved watching it. Like, I'm not even that much of a foodie person or like that interested in Michelin chefs, but it was just like such an engaging format to present this content. And it was so artistic and so lovely. And that was one of those sources that I was like, we've got this like very stale paranormal content that's been like coming out for the last 15 years, where they kind of found one or two formulas and just stuck to those. For me, it was really important. I was like, let's do something different. And I think that the paranormal can be a very intelligent genre. Like, I'm a big reader. I've got a lot of books about like people that have been, you know, doing a lot of really good intellectual research into this. I was like, let's level it up and not just make it about scares running around in the dark, and let's take it from a different angle. So that slow pace, thoughtful, a lot of interview stuff, a lot of artistic footage, that was a big influence on me. There was a bunch of others kind of stylistically too, like Hannibal, the TV series from Brian Fuller. Yes. Just like gorgeous.
I've been saying this since it came out. That's the most artful,
yes,
cable television series of all time.
Yeah.
If no one has seen that season two finale, that's best episode of cable television of all time.
It's just incredible. I love going back to that show over and over again. Just their use of color too, I think, is mm-hmm. really fantastic. Like, I think that there was a lot of very heavily graded TV shows around that period of time, because there's a handful of others as well. And I don't think you see that quite as much nowadays. So I think it was kind of a bit of a fad going that crazy with it, but I just loved it. And I still mm-hmm. love it every time I go back to it. So that heavily influenced my motivation to do like color work in that way as well. And then, of course, David Fincher, obviously he's a big influence. Like, I love the look of those films and the kind of vibe, you know, bringing like a True Detective influence into it with that sort of like weird supernatural feeling, rural component. A lot of the stuff I was consuming at that time. So kind of going back to that, like, I think that the slower, thoughtful pace was an important influence on it. And we did have a while before we started getting reviews come in. And we'd shot some of season two by that point, that season one had already come out. But like, I was aware of some of the reviews and how people found it too slow, or like didn't feel like enough was happening. And we had talked about that a bit, and that there was a lot of deliberate decisions to keep things, to keep some of those scenes kind of playing out at the pace that they did, because of the content that was in them. But still, hearing that kind of stuff, how does that influence future seasons? You know, like, how can I speed up the pace, but still keep it about that content and keep it a little bit more thoughtful? And part of that just helped too by having that variety that you talked about, where we did have a little bit more of a budget just from kind of what season one did. We took that profit and we put it right into season two. So on the hardware side, it allowed me to upgrade my gear, but it also gave us a little bit more money to go back and forth across the country to shoot more than just the once. So that worked well in terms of like giving us more content that we could like, you know, I was more aware that we had to fit more in to keep that pace up as we kind of jumped around. So I think it was a natural evolution, a little bit of conversations. I think we're talking more and more as a team and sharing more and more for that critique as we go forward with different projects. But I do remember season one was one that we talked about a fair bit, but not necessarily as much as we talk now. I remember delivering kind of the final episodes to Greg and Dana, and they watched them and they were just like, great job, dude. Like, we trust you. Like, you did good. Whereas now with this feature doc, like, we're sending cuts back and forth constantly and talking about edits and changes. So definitely an evolution on all fronts.
It's actually quite funny. I rewatched Hellier in preparation for this. I took extensive notes, and the one thing I couldn't nail down, even with all the complex story threads weaving in and out of both seasons, the one thing I couldn't nail down was the production timeline. Like, that's the thing that tripped me up.
Yeah, the timeline is one of the weirdest and hardest and fun parts about shooting Hellier, because I mean, whether or not you're talking about just the practical side of it or synchronicities and the way that the story evolves itself, like how you arrange that is a big element of the edit for Hellier. And watching season two is really funny, because not too many people I've heard do this, but you can go down a real rabbit hole, because I try to date stamp all the different scenes in Hellier. And they don't play out, or they play out in a very different order than they actually happened. So it's kind of a fun rabbit hole to pay attention to which scene is which date, and then see the actual arrangement of how it happened. And a lot of that was mostly story elements, but keeping threads going, because things get very disjointed. There's even now with like different things that we're shooting, like especially kind of with COVID to some extent, but sometimes you might have different people's schedules available at different times. Like Connor works at the Colorado State Capitol for 6 months out of the year. So we don't typically shoot very much as the whole team during January to June. And so if something's happening during that time, the team can be different. Sometimes when we are available, it's not feasible to pursue a certain topic yet. So we do something else when we're together. And so, you know, paying attention to it, it's like the new emails that are kind of a big part of the premise of season two, the Amy emails, those came in first, like long before season one came out and was released. Those came in probably about 6 months or so after we shot Hellier season one, but we don't introduce those until, you know, the fourth episode. So a lot of that though is because the stuff that we wound up shooting first, 6 months after that, even in December, was kind of wrapping up the final threads of season one. That, you know, if I could recut everything in hindsight, those first three episodes of season two, I would probably move into season one, because they're pulling on those threads and pieces that were kind of left unresolved from that first week of filming that we did for season one. And so we moved those first to get them out of the way. Then we brought in the emails. But even stuff in the last three episodes is completely out of order, just to keep the story making sense, because it's so convoluted as it is that it's just kind of easier to follow from A to B to C, even though we shot it, you know, B to C to A, so to speak.
As you kind of alluded to, there's so many different threads and so much footage there that there's probably millions of different variations and alternate versions of Hellier that could have existed.
Yeah.
But I imagine that that was both fun and a huge responsibility and undertaking as an editor to both retell and sort of frame the story in a creative way, with some things thrown in like foreshadows. I always try to pay attention to the first shot of a film. Is this something I like to do? And the first shot of Hellier is of a tin can, which was obviously a deliberate addition on your part as an editor. Was that fun for you?
It's a lot of fun. I think it's probably a similar experience to what a lot of editors have when they sit down with a project, whether they shot it or whether it's somebody else's, where it starts out daunting and then it's super fun because you just get to launch in and start arranging it. And especially for me as someone that's just like kind of learned a lot by just consuming a lot of content. A lot of it's by gut. So you're kind of sitting there just like drawing on the stuff that you've watched recently and the stuff that you love and some of those techniques and, you know, starting off with a bit of a flash forward like that. That one was like, now that I think about it, I haven't thought about it in a while, but probably kind of prestige style, you know, like, where you start out with this shot that's like incredibly important, kind of in a giveaway sort of a sense. But because it's out of context, everyone forgets about it until they perhaps rewatch it later on. And I really enjoyed that sort of just like having those threads interweave that way. But with a lot of editing, sometimes you run up against a brick wall and you're tearing your hair out because you want to tell it one way, but it doesn't work that way. We're literally doing that with the feature doc right now, where sort of the arrangement of when you introduce some characters, when you tell this part of the story, should it go the other way around? Does it flow? Does the tension stay? All those sort of questions. It's fun because it's a fun exercise. And I love the surprise of like when a scene works and you're like, oh yeah, that sells it. And the sort of frustration of like feeling like it's not working, but not knowing if other people would have that same sense, if you're too close to it, because you've watched it 200 times now. That's just the complications, I think, of editing. And I think that using frameworks can be helpful, you know, like some rules, basic storytelling rules, I think are very helpful. But I think that's part of the fun of it, is to not think about that so much and go by the gut and see what naturally and organically develops. And maybe to fall back on some of those frameworks if you're really stuck. But it's a fun exercise, but it's not without its occasional frustration.
That reminds me of a note I had written down while rewatching season 2, that you guys felt like you were almost being guided, and that you were letting the story go where you felt you were being guided to take it. Not only as an editor, but in the midst of the production itself, how does that affect your role as director? When you're sort of letting, how do I put it, something bigger,
yeah,
more spiritual, the synchronicities themselves sort of direct the film instead of you.
Yeah, I'm glad you bring that up, because it's a, I think, both something that any sort of like documentary filmmaker appreciates, and also something that is kind of funny for us. Because anytime you're shooting real world stuff, like, you've got the inherent discrepancy between a fiction or a crafted story having beginning, middle, end, and you get to guide the themes and the progression of that story where you want them if you're creating them. And when you're shooting real life is rarely, if ever, that tidy. You know, there is no beginning, middle, and end. It's just a constant middle. And so with any documentary, it's, you know, the director or the editor or the producer, whoever's, you know, the guiding force behind it, it's their job to craft that in a direction that gives it a semblance of all three sections there, or whichever, however many parts of a storytelling you're telling. And we ran into that really head first with season 1, because we shot just this single block of time. And at that point, we were trying to figure out, like, is this the end? Is this the whole project? You know, like, do we have to wrap this up? Is it going to keep going? Are we going to get enough for a season 2? Enough content, I mean. How do we put a bow on this super open-ended thing where, in a lot of ways, we didn't really get any answers at all? We just felt like the story wasn't finished yet. So crafting that's kind of the fun art form of it, where you try to bring your themes together and put a bow on a couple of them and see where it goes. We joke all the time, because it does feel like when you're being like, these synchronicities feel guided. Like, that's the thing about synchronicity is it's this, for that cosmic coincidence to happen between completely unrelated events, the implication and the weight of it feels like there is an arranging of these events to correspond for the person that experiences that. And that's, you know, cosmic. That's like God level. That's like fundamentals of reality when these events are aligning beyond just a coincidental, like, that should just happen sometimes. So it does have that sense to it. It feels like it's more of a guided thing, especially when you get into season 2 stuff and you take two completely different events and all of a sudden they're aligning, and it feels like we were on a single path the whole time as we went down these different branches and avenues of the case, that we've started to joke now that the writers are the ones in charge. The writers are the ones in charge of this whole case, you know, like whether that's the phenomenon, as we call it, you know, or something else, something bigger. It becomes the joke because people ask us about, like, is season three going to happen? Is this it? We always kind of toss it up to the writers, because for me, you know, we are starting to shoot season three now that the world's getting a little bit back to us being able to shoot. For me though, like, I keep going back to this idea that I'm telling a real life story, documentary style, but I want it to feel like a scripted series almost. And if I was writing this as a scripted series, like, I don't want to get too far away from, like, David Christie and Terry Rist at the end of the day, because it's too easy to take this and just 7 seasons later, and we're still looking in caves for goblin sightings because it's, you know, we're goblin hunters on sci-fi or something. I want to keep that on that focused story. And so for me, if we're coming out with another season, we've got content to start shooting it. We are. But I'm like, if I come out with a season three, I want to have something big that, like, gets us back on that train. It doesn't have to be like a case solving thing, but I want some of these threads from early on to come back in. If I was writing this, I would want that to happen. But the more further along we get, the more it's kind of like, are we ever going to hear from these people? Like,
right.
They're very 5 years ago or 10 years ago now in the story, like, we might never hear from them again. So, that's when we say, we're like, well, the writers have taken us along this far. Hopefully they're writing a good story and not just giving us breadcrumbs, and that will continue to happen. So, it's kind of a cosmic long-winded way of saying, like, there's definitely some craft to it, and we do our best to kind of, like, pick the threads that are in the right direction. And I do my best to edit those threads cohesively and bring themes together to guide it. But at the same time, like, if this is like a somewhat supernatural phenomenon that is giving us these breadcrumbs, in a way that feels very conscious, I hope that they continue to guide the story into a place that eventually will conclude in a satisfying way, because definitely a lot of that is out of our hands, though.
You mentioned you were also an author. You've written books. Why do you think film was the best medium for Hellier? Or do you think it was the medium that best captured the story?
It's kind of funny because I never really thought about it. I think so much of that initial circumstance was just that when I first heard it, it was on a podcast. There was also Greg's kind of initial blog post or two about it. So that was kind of a written version of the story. So maybe in some sense, when I heard that podcast, I felt like it hadn't been presented visually yet. And I felt like it could. I was also, like, obviously deeply in the headspace of, like, wanting to shoot paranormal television, literally on the hunt for a story since the Stanley wrapped up. Connor and I were trying to find a new haunted location that we could go investigate on the regular and film. We weren't having luck with that. It's very important to me as a storyteller from the get-go, or as a filmmaker, I guess, from the get-go, that doing a formulaic ghost show isn't interesting to me, because I want to tell a story. Like, I think that those story pieces are far more interesting and just important and pertinent, and people respond to them much better. And so I was just in that headspace where I had a vision for a paranormal story, and here was an excellent paranormal story. I want to film it, you know? And so it was never really a thought about what the best medium for it was. Since then, you know, we think about every couple of months, you know, we think about the future where it would be nice to, like, publish a book about it, because Mothman Prophecies is such a wonderful account of paranormal phenomena, and it's such a great read. And Hellier is a different story in a lot of ways, but I think that there's a lot more research and nuance that only gets harder and harder to present in Hellier, because you can't really do an episode where it's just an episode of, like, 2 minute asides where we go, oh, this was weird. Oh, this was weird. And this was too. And there's more and more of that all the time that we want to share, because a lot of it is crazy, but it just doesn't always translate to film. So I think the way that a lot of stories can work in a lot of different formats, so too does Hellier. So I'm not sure necessarily that a series was the best one for Hellier. It was just the one that I was the most excited about doing at the time. But I do think, especially as a book, There's a lot of room for that in the future. And maybe that was a COVID project that should have happened and didn't, but I think often about sitting down at the keyboard and trying to like compile a lot of those things that people don't know about yet before we all forget about them, because that happens too.
Was there a particular shot or sequence in Hellier that made you sit back and think, yes, this is why I made this. This is why it's a film. This is what I wanted to capture visually and get across to the audience. Anything in particular jump out?
I think in season one in particular, it was walking to the train tunnel. It could be for as kind of drab an answer as just like, that was probably the most of what I had in my head before we shot, you know, like I didn't want night vision. I wanted to do it with lanterns because I thought that would look cool and different. I imagined us like going through the woods with these lanterns, looking for goblins, the anamorphic format with the flares and the widescreen, and then the color grade. And I think that scene, like walking through the brush, feeling all Jurassic Park and shit, that one comes to mind. I think also the gas station scene, now that I've rambled for a minute and thought about it, I think the gas station scene in episode two, probably like one of my highlights of the whole project. It looked really great. That Sony that I didn't use right half the time came through for that one. Color was beautiful. It was weird. It was eerie. It had that sort of the same fear that we kind of had there, I think, translated through the screen and just that kind of like eeriness and almost disappointment from that scene, I suppose, in the first season, because we didn't get much from that visit right there. But it again, like the other one, it looked like how I wanted it to look. And more importantly for that scene though, it felt the way that I wanted it to feel. And so I think that one, arriving at the gas station, you know, the motorcycle going by, and then as the sun goes down, us talking around the lantern to some of the locals, I think those stand out in my mind as just kind of like what I wanted with Hellier and it coming through.
Now, before we wrap this interview up, where can people follow you and your future work?
You know, I'm probably most active on Instagram and Twitter, Carl Pfeiffer and Carl W. Pfeiffer. Throw those in a Google with Hellier, and I'm sure that you can find those places if you don't know the spelling. We are putting together the finishing touches on a feature-length documentary with the same crew as Hellier. So you'll recognize all the folks in that. Release is up in the air because these things are always complicated that way. But hopefully it's coming out this year at some point down the road. So keep your eyes peeled for that. There's no way that if you're a Hellier fan, you will miss it because we will certainly blow up the internet with promo and trailers and stuff when that comes out. But that's the next thing. And then as always, Hellier 3 circling in the background, waiting for its moment. And that one, yeah. I think that one will come out of nowhere for people when it's finally ready to come out of its cave after hibernation. So, but that's good place as any. Yeah, I like how I lapsed into a cave metaphor there with Hellier non-intentionally. So how perfect.
So with that, I just want to give another huge thank you to Carl for taking the time to chat with me about filming Hellier. And once again, I want to thank you for listening. As always, Filming the Supernatural is an Afterlife Road production. If you like what you heard, be sure to rate the podcast 5 stars and give it a follow so you can be notified when brand new interviews get released.